I've heard the temptation struggles, isn't it having a temptation, but more that to feel this is a phase one goes through when a romance ends, and that she'll get over it, which is a very modern interpretation of the song. Mm-hmm. And I really feel her service to the songwriter as well. I think her delivery, her use of the lyric, just, it's very clear, it's very clean, and it isn't as much as perhaps owning the song as a holiday interpretation is, but I think that she does service to the song.
But she's doing service to a tradition.
Yes, and I think she's a very modern singer in the way she
that's interesting, because I played this for a group of graduate students, and a lot of them, I mean, my biases are around, but a lot of them felt the same way that you did, that this was a modern way that made this music, you know, accessible to them again. A bunch of people. I didn't know. Let me start here and go back. Okay.
I want to say that, well, everybody in this room probably had millions of reactions, but I find that I'm disturbed by the thing that you're reassured by in the front. I don't hear. I hear that she's identifying the voice completely with the song, and with a little help from the saxophone as well, that she really is, you know, I'm the person who's sad because my love has gone wrong. I find that the other two interpretations, that I'm going to pick up her Ethel Waters, that in different ways, both those women were using the situation of having been lost, having been left by your lover as metaphors for a kind of much more pervasive tragedy. You know, Ethel Waters was really complicated. I listened to her a lot. And in a way, she's saying, I'm a really good singer. I take real pleasure in singing this precisely and truly. And hitting the E and holding it on that was really an art song thing. But at the same time, she's saying, but the words aren't really true. She's saying, I think that as a black singer in those days, she was probably saying, you know I've been beaten down. You know I've been oppressed. We'll leave that aside. I'm going to sing you this song about love. It's a metaphor for a lot of things that have happened to me, but it's also not really true, because here I am singing before you, and I'm prosperous, and we're going to enjoy this and play a little bit.
And I'm also singing your song. I'm singing the way you talk about
yes.
it. You know, that.
And I think it's funny.
And I've taken it into myself, and I'm doing it beautifully.
Yes, but you can distance yourself from the lyrics, because we're playing with an artifact here, the song. Mm-hmm. I love whenever she says lover, because to me it's always, I'm from the north.
I know.
And I did catch
that's the great diction drama, yeah.
A little bit of the inverse in Linda Ronstadt, midnight, I can sing like the I find that Billie Holiday also absents herself from the text of the song, i.e. letting the listeners make all the things they want to of it and see it as an artifact, not you know, a thing clamped onto her, because she sounds so desperate and so low that when she sings the magic moonlight dies, you think these words are blasphemy. you can hardly contain the shame and the embarrassment of having to sing those words. Mm. And just as I was saying, she's way down below the text, even though inchoate, wordless hell. Then she comes out and connects with the line, at break of dawn, there's no sunrise, which is much less bejeweled and much simpler. And you think, this is where the words do mean something.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of the song, she pitches off again when she says, my lover is gone. It's almost as if she's telegraphing to the audience, okay, the song's over, I'm going to get drunk. I'm pitching headlong into oblivion. My lover is gone.
Good night.
So that her torment is way, way, way bigger than the text. Mm. Ethel Waters is doing better than the text of the song. Billie Holiday is way underneath. And Linda Ronstadt simply is the text of the song. And it's totally boring, because it's just about love. It's not about anything else.
No, it's very good. I'm being quiet now, because I've already made, but the strategies you're talking about are very interesting ones. And what you said, too, in terms of how you impose yourself onto the art, but also do it some service.
I found that the world is so constituted. They call a singer, they call a slam bird. Her voice really has a connection to a bird. We can also
I chose it for the very simple commercial reason that this is one of the best-selling, these two albums she's done, or popular songs, really are credited with the revival of this kind of music. You know, if you listen to WEW, which has been playing this music for years, they're always saying, Linda brought it back, we're getting the rock on. You know, it accomplished a major commercial coup in that way, and that's why I'm saying it. This music also, how you homogenize it through the radio waves, you know, which singers sort of become the, if you will, Johnny Mathis's of their era. And in some way, they're always the ones who most adapt themselves to the current, rather in the studio, which, you know, if you put it, if you like it, is in some way doing justice to the current times. Or if you don't like it, you know, you're just right along there for the ride, you know, whatever the medium wants, you get it. I'm interested in the connections are legion. I happen to be interested in how this kind of music reflects a whole kind of social and artistic history that women are involved in. It really helped pioneer that does have to do with everything from very intimate musical consideration to ego as an artist coming in, you know, to clash with the material given you, to how the musical is a cultural, social, emotional vehicle, you know, for all sorts of ambitions, all sorts of lies, if you will, the hiding of origins, the suppressing of it, you know, the Ethel Waters song, in a way. First, she does the kind of art ballroom version of it. You know, she was a wonderful mimic. She could do Mae West. She could do, you know, these sorts of 20s dowagers. In the middle, she lets loose with just a little, you know, I'm going to give you a kind of art version of what they might hear in those dirty clubs. And then she goes right back again. There's a whole history in that. Billie Holiday represents a musical advance, a moving of a sort of classical tradition of, you know, voice, instrument, song, much more into a kind of American speaking tradition, how the American voice, you know, transforms the words you're using. Also how certain previously unaccepted timbres, phrasings, improvisations, moved in to reshape a very fixed body of music and make it something else. What I'm interested in Melinda Ronstadt is, what is she doing that is making this music very, very palatable and desirable again? And is she doing something? Is it coming back in really a retro, to you as you say, music form that you find unacceptable? Or is it possible in some way to renew this somewhat musically and lyrically for women limited body of music? And if so, how? You know, how is one a popular singer of principle and of, you know, some kind of integrity that really spends this life
trying to I've suddenly seen it as when you were talking about your response to Linda Ronstadt and the text. Because as I was listening to it, I kept thinking, I wasn't the least bit interested in the words. Because to me, you could put in any old words into that sentence. Mm-hmm. Because it was homogenized.
Yes, it's the Nelson Riddle orchestra set.
One original musical idea.
That is a good point, because the history is as much the history of the kind of orchestration in the harmonic.
The irony is that this means that the lyrics to listeners who take the palpable musical sound as security,
yeah,
therefore find more in the lyrics. So I'm finding this. It means that the lyrics make more to
listeners.
Then? The response to this.
Oh, because.
You mean because the music, in fact, has been.
You're not listening to the music, it's a package.
It's lost all interest, so you're listening. The voice has been highlighted by the totally homogenized marshmallow of the music.
That's interesting.
I find that when I listen to her, she has absolutely no phrasing technique. I mean, to my ear, I have no interest in what she's saying, so ergo, I don't have any interest in the whole thing. I mean, I really lose interest in the whole piece, which is a very insidious, I mean, it has insidious implications for why this is so palatable. I mean, does she completely, she depains it, it's like her interpretation sort of denudes it, and of any kind of, you know, pain or power that it could have.
Yeah.
I don't think she does ever. Right, I mean, there's really nothing there. There's no there there.
Yes, but what is the package?
It's AirSat sort of pre-digested, lovely background music, maybe. I mean, maybe that's what people...
Background romance music.
It reminded me of, like, I mean, maybe people my age, in their mid-20s, early 30s, remember learning to dance to music like that in their living rooms. Only it wasn't this, it was the real thing. So it's got this familiarity to it that's very comfortable. But at the same time, it has absolutely no challenge. I mean, there's no challenge there to listen or to hear the pain or whatever is in, you know, the singer's interpretation.
Just a point that occurs to me so that one can link some of these diverse things. Those of you who've seen Manhattan and Hannah and Her Sisters will remember that Woody Allen, more than any other film director, uses old music constantly. And in terms of what you said, Elizabeth, now I'm trying to think on my feet, it's interesting because when you hear it, I'm a sucker for it. I hear Louis Armstrong or even Harry James or Gershwin in a movie, and I'm happy because I think movie music is some of the most primitive and horrible, you know, and its relationship to, you know, the dramatic narrative is horrible, but I hear that and I go happy, and then suddenly I start to get angry because I realize he's giving you that carpet. The carpet is the nostalgia of this old music, and over it are his words, which are taking something from the comfortable feelings you're getting from all this old music, and are taking on a certain kind of timeless glow. You know, that makes you not pick, here's a funny remark, but, you know, there are a couple holding hands walking down the street. It gives them a sort of universality and credibility they mightn't otherwise take on. So it's a funny thing. Yeah. I'm going to tell you, because I have it here, one of our numerous
Trivial Pursuit.
East Swan.
Whoever East Swan.
It's a great chestnut. It's a song that I think I've very rarely heard a man sing. It's usually, you know, there's certain male torch ballads.
Is there male? Do you think East Swan is male?
Not sure with the initial. Probably.
Yeah.
Ken Hannah, there are only a few on Tin Pan Alley, but you never know. I should have looked it up. Yeah.
I just have a sort of response and a talk to your interpretation. I kind of want to but equally say, rather than saying that because the music is sort of packaged out of existence, one can focus on the words, I would equally say that perhaps that is the message, that the message is made accessible to a certain modern sensibility, which can recognize and respond and even perceive the message if it is a sort of stylization, like the sorts of yucking bars up on the side, where what is being stylized is sort of, as I said, stylization, and that in fact makes that message meaningful, perhaps, to the modern. I don't know, it just seemed to me equally plausible or feasible interpretation rather than just thinking that the music proceeds. I think that is the music. I think we're saying the same thing often that by creating a highly mannerist, highly stylized where there's nothing at all, when I say original, I mean arresting, musically intrusive. nothing to catch the ear, right? Or the imagination musically, that then pushes, in the terms of perspective, it pushes the lyrics forward. But to me, the message of the lyrics had lost its meaning. So precisely, and what I'm saying, I guess, is perhaps I'm just taking it one step further, but perhaps in a sense, that is what meaning is today. There's something that's shifted its meaning in a sense, and become sort of homogenized, I mean, homogenization, exemplified, as it were, that is the meaning.
And certainly reassuring, which also fits in with what you were saying about everybody, the other two singers, in some way, in some dynamic relationship to this text. The music and the lyrical text, and her just...
It's something more of
true. But I said to love.
If you write that,
think you are. Love is just, it's
a badge of experience, a badge of sensibility, self-congratulatory experience.
And also an acceptable form, if you will, of emotional music. You know, the same way Woody Allen movies are for an upper class, the way for an upper middle class, the way certain TV shows might be for another constituency.
But if one doesn't feel an angst about an experience that is suggested with these songs, that is, with this lyric, which I don't think it's a, you know, an terribly excellent lyric. I think it's a nice song, so I'm not going to make more of the song, but it's asking to. I did suggest that I think she's doing service to her. And she's, I think what I get from the song, and I really feel like I've what a 30, but that's all right, because I've got it, I'm very vocal, is that she's doing service to what I feel is a contemporary experience of the song. She isn't angst-ridden, she isn't
feeling something that she
does not feel. And however, I do feel that she's interpreting it how she does feel. Now, if we're in disagreement with how she does feel, or if we associate that strictly with the application, then we're saying that perhaps that a modern experience does not do justice to interpretation of songs in contemporary society, and that perhaps the only good songs, now we would go back to where you were right at the beginning of things, is that you can't revive or revivify or whatever these types of songs, that they belong to different periods. But that would be untrue to say that, because Ethel Waterford sang it, and then 25 years later, Holiday did, and she revived it during another period. So
it's true, though it is possible that the conditions, the given, the sort of charming conventions, you know, the way 18th century drama had conventions, were so vital for this, let's say, let's start with the 20s. 20s to certainly 20s through 50s, and then, you know, it began to shake its hold, this music, was so vital for a good 30 years. They so matched the conventions of the larger society, you know, that they kept, even with, you know, most homogenized versions, a certain kind of, you know, mass culture, you know, alive appeal. And that really, in some ways, perhaps, certain things have changed so much or been challenged so much that they can no longer keep that kind of present-day journalistic, if you will, musically journalistic vitality, and either move into some kind of classy music. I mean, we hate to use the word music, but there's no group of people too educated not to have their own form of music, or they become a kind of art song, though ironically, Ethel Waters made as much an art song as certainly
music.
You know, maybe any kind of real you know, maybe for a certain kind of popular romance music, for tradition to continue, it's really going to have to come from something like that. You know, no longer from the world of convention, musical and lyrical, set up by a group of popular songwriters. You know, with a certain set of living according to a certain kind of social and musical groups. Let me do two covers for you, because we're almost in it. This is a Rodgers and Hammerstein song called, you know, again, the classic female, whatever, If I Loved You, If I Loved You, the Coy, I'm Timing It On. You all know this from Carousel, right? One of the, you know, first American musicals said to have the seriousness of an opera, because words and story were completely integrated. From the remake of an old Molnar, God, I think around World War I, Hungarian play called Milena. So think of American music, Rodgers and Hammerstein, very consciously creating a kind of ballad that was meant to be a tribute to Central European balladeering, if you will, a certain kind of very fixed heroine. First I'm going to play, the themes come back in this workshop, a Quincy Jones arranged version by Dinah Washington. Now this was done in the 1961. And what you're going to hear is a lush orchestral arrangement battling with a backbeat that is country and rhythm and blues, which represents this strange moment when popular radio music of this sort was suddenly being besieged by rock and roll. And people like Dinah Washington were taking these popular ballads and pushing them into a kind of jukebox R&B country way, but also trying to keep a kind of, you know, violin-laden, almost Nelson Riddle arrangement that would make them palatable to older viewers. So you're hearing a lot of clashes. You're also hearing a singer who comes out of black gospel music and blues, but moved into jazz, trying to impose that style or work with that style in a song that essentially is all kind of legato soprano thing. You know, here Quincy Jones being corrected. No, it's interesting. I shouldn't have said that.
Marvel, I didn't know he was a young
one. Oh, boy, yeah. He was a young wunderkind who came along in the 50s. And, you know, one of these, again, this Gun for Hire, who played trumpet, I think, with Count Basie. He played with a couple of big bands, then moved into arranging. And, you know, worked with a lot of great people like this. And, you know, I'm going to have to fast forward a bit. You're going to miss Carrie Tacoma and Peggy Lee because we're talking over. This is a strange one. Starts you know, if there's such a thing as non-sexual promiscuousness, which of course there is, like, you know, reporting with everybody, Andy Gibb, Donna Summer, you know, anybody, it doesn't matter, this whole, you know, range, odd range of whoever is the pop rock star of the moment, records with Barbara and is glad to, because that gives them a kind of pop Broadway credibility that they don't have as rock musicians, but it gives her a kind of, I'm of the moment, I'm Barbara Streisand, you know, I'm not Carol Chen, younger sister. Now, having done all of that and made herself very rich, she moves back this year into, I'm returning to my roots, as she calls it, not Brooklyn, you know, nothing else but the Broadway show. I've been away far too long, I'm the prodigal daughter, I'm returning to the music that made me, and I am bringing it implicitly, you know, this kind of, I'm bringing it my worldly treasures.
Going to ruin a lot of things for me.
No, she's a very talented woman. I'm deliberately laying on her. Now, you remember, I'm sure, the original song. Let me put it on my
It should be that.
But it's feeling it's tight. Weird. Let me try my little take with her, which I bought, just in case something was off. Mine does not have a great sound.
You're going to love holding hands.
Yeah.
I should hope so.
All right.
Kill you. It didn't matter what the lyrics were.
in some ways it almost doesn't matter what the music is, because it, you know, I understand that.
Yeah.
But for me, listening now, and I've listened to this album before, it's that there's something pretty that has to be mimicked. It's not an intelligent music or an intelligent lyric. Now, for some reason, when I, Callas never cared whether her voice sounded good. She cared about the drama that was going to come through the music, and if it meant she cut her voice, or it sounded like a jagged edge, she would do it. Sills was a little less that, but often that, you know? And for some reason, I've, what I've been trying to think of is the metaphor of women and performing, and how, when I used to talk, when I was not a feminist, we used to talk about the performer can never be the genius. Only the creator can
that's
be the genius, right?
That's one of the great cultural, pieties.
But thinking about how you can make creativity in the performance, and how it's not, how it isn't, I mean, I don't know how to say it, because I'm not as...
So what do you feel about this?
I hate this music. But I like the album. I hate the West Side Story thing.
Do you hate the song or do you hate her interpretation?
I don't like the song. But the album, no, I never liked the song. Even as a kid, I didn't like it. A couple of times in my life, I had good taste. But I like a lot on this album. I don't like the West Side Story. I hate that part. But I think there are pieces on this that are sort of fun. And I find her a more interesting performer than
Strauss. I think that even when this,
not when you match them together,
this to me
so
still has some of that homogenized following. I mean, it's shocking to me that all these years, and here are Ronstadt and Streisand producing these incredible period, you know, these like reconstructions in the Met's costume museum, the whole costume. Yet I listen to her and I think, damn, she does know how to deliver, you know, a lyric. She knows how to create, however false, you know, the same way a good actress in the worst piece of schlock in the world will, a certain moment of believability. It enrages me, but I think it's there. Though again, I'm thinking it is bringing the words back, some highest acceptance and revering and iconizing of the lyrics in some way that is just shocking to me.
It reminds me of the current sort of crisis that's being written about of American fiction, and this whole sort of batch of the new short stories, and Bright Lights, Big City being one of the quintessential examples.
It's the short story pretending to be a novel. Right?
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's real good technique, like you were saying. The technique is great, there's no soul. Somehow it's morally deficient, or there are some things, again, there's no there there. I mean, and what does that mean about the culture? I mean, what kind of culture is consuming these things, these messages that aren't really messages, that are just impotent enough not to be threatening or agitating in any way?
Well, is there any artist that you can suggest, and I'm not meaning to put you on the spot, but is there anybody, a contemporary artist, who you do feel has soul? Because I'd like to know.
Their contemporaries would have probably hated it.
Maybe, but we're talking about mass pop culture. And mass pop culture, what's popular in pop culture doesn't usually last.
I'm not sure I agree with you, and I'm not sure that's fair. I think a lot of this music, which is why I'm in the conundrum about it, deserves to last as much as a lot of later I'm still listening to. You know, I really, really do. I believe a lot of movies deserve to last, you know, longer than...
We're talking about mass pop culture, we're not talking about pop culture. That's okay. The difference. I'm not 50 years, somebody who was like Billie Holiday, who died very young, who was doing popular culture songs, who had something very special, and who I'm sure will outshine myself, I'm sure I'll outshine other spice in the world, and that's my point.
Yeah.
We don't know,
we don't have the history. Yeah, no, that's quite true. But also future generations, you know, I'm obviously setting it up as in some way, you know, it all feels perilous and oddly, you know, and what's the future of an art form and what does it say about the culture at large? You know, I look at things now that my equivalent 50 years ago would have looked at and been horrified by, and I get only pleasure out of it because there's a surface, you know, prettiness. The music, the singer, and those pop moments where everything's just working just right together. Who knows? You know, but the history of it is endless and fascinating to me. And as I say, there still is this sort of, I'm always a little unnerved when a form, you know, reaches a new form, however sophisticated, a genre of homogenization. It doesn't necessarily alarm me in a department store, but it does here. So I'm curious as to who these other people are who will do something with this, if something can be done, other than what two very slow craftspeople. Anyway, there's something else to go to. Thank you. We didn't use it because it turned out to be the wrong machine for my purpose.